Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
This is a speaker meeting. I will speak for 10 minutes and turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Babette, who will share her experience, truth, and hope.
Or not.
Yeah. Oh my God, my band-aid's coming off. It's not good. My name is Eric, I'm an alcoholic. I'm really super nervous, so bear with me, please. I haven't spoken in a meeting in a really long time, or stood up in a group of people and shared like this. So, just a really quick background. I had 7 years, and I went back out, and I have 60 days today. I've been on like a three-year run, and I'm in rehab right now. I'm at the Salvation Army. What's up? Hello. My bed's made by 7:30 in the morning and all that shit. And I go to groups and I attend them and I actually like them today. So, but I'll just give you a little, I grew up in an alcoholic home, really bad alcoholics and a lot of drugs. And I grew up pretty fucked up. And I never felt like I fit in. And I grew up hating myself. And I grew up just wanting to be loved, basically. And that's gone through, that story's gone through my whole life. Just that feeling of wanting to be loved. And I've looked through everything to find that. And I've only found it in this room. So that's why I keep coming back here. And if you're new and you feel that way right now, you will be loved. And like, I just, one thing I want to say is that you never have to be that person again. That's what I was first told when I got here, is that you never have to be that person ever again. And that's how I feel today, that I don't have to be that person today. So with that, yeah, like, life is really good right now for me. I have 60 days, like I said, and the compulsion to use has kind of been lifted at this moment in time, just today. I've had, the past 3 years, I've gone in and out of these rooms constantly where I became the newcomer that I used to hate when I had 7 years. Like, just constantly raising their hand over and over again as a newcomer, and I just say, like, fuck, I wish you'd fucking get it, you know, and cop a resentment. And also want to say, if you're in here and you don't want to be in here and you have some time, like, please keep coming back. Because I stopped coming back, and that's when I went back out, and it's been hell coming back. So let me just say, it's hell out there. It's not fun. It's just not good anymore. Once you've been in here, it's just so not fun. It's not worth it at all. So yeah, you know, like right now, I'm working the steps. I'm just trying to stay focused, and you know, just not. Try not to be too much in my head. I don't know. Sorry, guys, I'm really nervous. I'm trying to calm down. I'm gonna shake it off. You know, like, oh, what are you talking about? I like look up and there's all of you. I'm like, oh no, what's up? One thing that's happening for me today is that I'm grateful. You know, like, God is working in my life, and God is a big part of my life right now. I wake up in the morning, and I do the third and seventh step prayer, and I ask for God to remove the obsession and compulsion to drink, to do drugs, and for me, it's boys. So, I just don't, because that's what takes me out every time. And so I'm just learning to be with myself. Like, I've had a really hard time being with myself, and today I'm forced to be with myself, which is great. And, I'm super grateful for my rehab I'm in. I never thought I would say I'd be grateful for rehab, but I am. I'm really grateful for my rehab. And I'm really grateful that I get to be sober today and have God in my life. I didn't think I was going to make it back here alive. This is my fourth treatment center in a row. So, and I've had a lot of relapses. And this is the first time I've gotten 60 days in about 2 years. And that's a big deal for me. And you know, and so, like, today it's just about showing up, and, you know, Zephyr asked me to speak, and so I was like, okay, I'll speak in this meeting, and that's because that's what you're supposed to do, and so that's what I've done, and so, like, I just feel so much better that I'm actually participating in Alcoholics Anonymous instead of being in the back. I used to sit in the back and sigh all the time when certain people shared. I was like, you know what I'm saying? Like the center squares, you know, the ones that always share. And like, I'm like, fuck, I know they're going to talk about that dog or something, you know? And so, but today it's like, talk about the dog. Let's do it. You know what I mean? Because that's how I feel. I just, you know, I just want to dig into this program because I just don't want to go back out there because I just, you know, the core of all of this is that I just want to be loved. You know what I mean? And through my using and everything, I'm a crystal meth addict and an alcoholic. And there's a lot of stuff that comes along with crystal meth addiction. And I'm working through all that right now as well. But, you know, the core of it is just, I just want to be loved. And, like, right now I'm just learning to open up my heart and let people in and do it sober and do it in a safe place. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our main speaker, Bovette. So thank you.
My name's Bovette, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bovette.
I'm also nervous. When Hannah and Morgan asked me to speak, I, you know, was, oh, sure. And then today I said to my wife, actually. I keep wanting to say girlfriend, but my wife. That's a hard one to learn. Anyway, I kept saying to her, now, why did I say I would do this? And really, you know, it's kind of one of those things. It was New Year's Eve. It seemed like a good idea at the time. So. Anyway, and I just made Eric sit and look at a picture and listen to the story about my dog before the show. So now I know what he knows.
I love it.
thanks a lot, Eric. Oh, dear. Well, you know, actually, helps me sometimes just to talk a little bit about what's going on now before I get into, oh, it all started in a small town in Oklahoma. So I'll just say, I just came back from Hawaii. We call them working vacations. My father is, he just turned 90 and is in assisted living over there, and I'll tell you all about that later. But, we go over there to help him, and that's where I did a lot of drinking and where I first went to my first AA meeting 40 years ago. So I see all you young people out there. I am an old person. it was research. It really was research. I was doing a script for the first co-ed halfway house in Hawaii. And the person who was my contact suggested I go to some AA meetings to learn about alcoholism. And boy, does that fuck up your drinking. I was 22, and I did not want to be an alcoholic, and all those people were talking about things that I thought only went on inside of me, and I was just freaked. So I spent the next 10 years trying to prove I was not an alcoholic. I refer to them as my social drinking years. But, so I just celebrated 30 years in Hawaii. And as I mentioned at the meeting where Morgan and Hannah asked me to speak, I wanted to go to a meeting that was close to my house and that was different from the meetings that I've been going to recently. And there's this daily meeting there called Spiritual Awakening. And it's at 6:30 in the morning. Now, for the three people in this room who know me, I am not a morning person. If I'm up at 5:30 in the morning, it's because I haven't been to bed. And but I decided I would get up at 5:30 and I would go to this meeting. And my parents' house where I stay is up in this hill, and you drive down and you look, for those of you who know Hawaii, you look into Diamond Head, and it's lovely. And at that hour of the morning, I was surprised to see that the main volcano sides are all dark, and the sun was shining right into it, and it looked like this bowl of light. And I thought, spiritual awakening indeed. And also, that'll be the last time I see that. I'm not getting up at this hour again. But it was really lovely. And so I went to this meeting. It was a very large meeting. And I just couldn't believe that many people were up at that hour going to an AA meeting. And so they go around, and everybody, just like they did here, everybody goes around and they say, you know, like we did. And so I announced that it was my birthday, and all of a sudden, this woman gets up, and she runs, and she comes back in. She has this little kukui nut lei, and she puts it over, and I was, thank you very much. And 2 minutes later, another woman comes in, and she puts another lei over me, and oh, thank you very much. And then this guy gets up, and he leaves for a while, and he comes back, and he has gone home and made me this flower. It's called pua kenekene. It's just really fierce in terms of smell. I had to put it outside. But it was very sweet of him, and he put that over me. And then all of a sudden, this woman came over, and she gave me my 30-year chip. And then they passed it all the way around the room, and everybody in the room puts their love into it, and their aloha, and, you know, so forth and so on. It's just, it's very sweet, actually. It really is. It's wrong, but it's very sweet. And then when they hand you your chip, you know you have to speak. So, anyway, so that was my experience. But, you know, I left that meeting and I just was so grateful to be an alcoholic. And the other thing that happened there, though, is I do not get up and say the third step and the seventh step prayer and all of that. For those of you who think you're doing it wrong, I have never learned them. Which is the other thing I told at this meeting when they were there. So they go at the end of the meeting, they say all the prayers by heart, holding hands. I do not know them. You know, and as I said the other night, I do know the St. Francis prayer, but I know it the right way, not the way it's in the book, you know. So I'm sitting there holding hands with these people, and they're all, you know, God, I put my hand in, and I'm... And then I don't even know how the seven step one prayer is. But I offer myself to thee. Is that the one?
That's third step.
See, I'm not joking. I really don't know. But anyway, and then we get to this 11th step, and I think, oh, good, at least I know this one. And they say it wrong. So, but, you know, it just doesn't matter. There's room for all of us. There's room for us, whether we say the prayers or we don't. And it's not to say I don't pray every morning, because I do. But I'll tell you about that later. So now we get to that part. So I'm an Army brat. And I don't come from an alcoholic home per se. There's lots of alcoholism in my family. We don't call them alcoholics. We just call when you hide bottles all over the house and don't tell people that you're drinking. We call that... Well, we don't call it anything, actually. My grandfather died. He had hidden bottles all over the house. My grandmother, who was a formidable force and lived to be 105... said, I don't understand. Ralph has not had a drink in 50 years. You know, every one of us grandchildren had been drinking with my grandfather. But in her mind, he had stopped drinking. Why were there bottles, you know? Turns out there's alcoholism on both sides of my family, which I didn't know. I just recently, or 4 years ago, learned that both my cousins on my father's side are sober. One has been sober a year less than I have. The other has been sober 10 years. And there's alcoholism on the other side of the family. So, you know, I come by it honestly, but not in my immediate family. We had cocktail hour. In the Army, you have cocktail hour. And we had cocktail parties. When you move from one place to another, you go to, you know, the parents go to cocktail parties. When I was a kid, I used to love cocktail parties because as my parents were saying goodbye to everybody, I would go around with a little glass and just empty everybody's leftovers into a glass and drink it. I just thought that was great. I loved alcohol. I loved it from the very beginning. My favorite drink were whiskey sours as a kid. And when I was playing with our neighbor kids, they used to like to play Sunday school. This really was Oklahoma. And they were talking about serving their Sunday school class, you know, like orange juice and things like that. And all of a sudden my mother hears me say, I'm going to serve my Sunday school class whiskey sours. I couldn't even say whiskey. I called them whiskey sours. And the mother grabbed her kids, went home, and wouldn't let them play with me again. But that said, I was a good girl. You know, I was raised at a time when you didn't drink in high school. If you did, you were a hood. So I didn't drink. Didn't drink, didn't smoke. Good grades, college prep, all that sort of stuff. Went off to, was a Girl Scout. Serious Girl Scout. Girl Scout all the way through high school. Girl Scout into college. A straight Girl Scout. Went to Roundup, which is an international encampment. 10,000 women. And I didn't know I was gay. What a waste. So my first solemn oath about alcohol was when I went away to college. And it was, I absolutely promised that I would not drink until I was 21. And I was 17 when I went to college. I went to Rush Week. And my parents had both gone to Midwestern universities, and they expected me to join a sorority. They were sorority fraternity people. And my mother said, "Now I don't want you to feel like you need to join mine. Whichever one works for you." I was a really earnest kid. God, I sat there and I tried to figure out which one to join. So finally I made my decision, and that's the one I joined. And I called my parents up, and my mother said, "What was wrong with her sorority?" And hung up and wouldn't speak to me. So school had started. I was off on the wrong foot. I already knew I'd made a mistake. But anyway, that was the week between rush week and college. And I went to a party with my boyfriend, whom I met that first week. And somebody handed me a drink. It was 7-7. And I took that drink, and I finished it and turned to him and said, "This time, just leave out the 7-Up. Those were the end of my Girl Scout days. I mean, I took those solemn oaths seriously, so that ended the Girl Scout days, and that was the beginning of my drinking. And I might not have looked like an alcoholic, but if you'd watched me drink at that point in my life, and if you'd known anything about alcoholism, you would have known that if I was a lucky person, I would end up in this room. Because right from the beginning, I drank differently than any of my friends. Right from the beginning, I drank differently than anybody I knew. And years later, when I was sober and talked to those people, and would say things, you know, like, "Well, I don't know if you noticed, but I used to drink a little." And they'd go, "Oh, yes." So alcohol poisoning came to being given, you know, being resuscitated. All I could think about was, you know, I'd had 17 bottles of champagne. And all I could think about was just more. Oh, gosh. It was problematic from the beginning, but it was fun. And here's the thing. I told you, I thought I'd made a mistake. School hadn't even started. I thought I'd made a mistake. I had a really hard relationship with my mother. My mother, God love her, was an abusive person. She grew up being abused with a ruler. She said she would never do that. She went to a yardstick. Today, I would have been taken out of my home, seriously, for the way I went to school. She was verbally abusive. She was emotionally abusive. We had a hard relationship. I spent a lot of years, a lot of time fighting her. And so I wanted to get away from home, but I was terrified. Because when you have somebody who's constantly, you know, controlling your life like that, even though you spend a lot of time, or even though I spent a lot of time, you know, rebelling, bless you, rebelling against it, I didn't really have the skills or whatever to be on my own. And I was terrified. And so when I found this Seagram 7, god-awful stuff, really. Much preferred better booze than that later. But when I found that, it was like this magic elixir. It was the answer. You know, I felt one of you. I felt like I could go through college. I felt like, you know, it took the edge off. The problem was, the longer I drank, the more edges there were. The longer I drank, the less it made me socialize, the more it made me have the courage to tell you to go fuck yourself, but which is not accepted in most social circles as socially, you know, acceptable behavior. So anyway, I was having a little trouble with school because, as my wife over here says, you know, when I drank, it was a career choice. And so I wasn't really attending class that often. And so I started using amphetamines. Not the hard stuff like you, but, you know, a little dexedrine here and there. I'm going to give you, here's an example. This is me on dexedrine. So the first time I ever tried it, this friend who lived next door, her boyfriend was a doctor. We were very careful about this, and he brought us these pills. He said, "Okay, now I want you to take this now while you're studying," because I hadn't read any of the material and had two exams. "And then tomorrow, before your first exam, you take the other one." Okay. So I took the first one, and the two of us sat up all night telling each other our life stories. and then speed reading. It was like taking an Evelyn Wood reading dynamics class. It was fabulous. Just now I go down to breakfast. I wasn't a breakfast eater. I had a coffee and a cigarette for breakfast. I went down for breakfast. You have this lineup of all these things to eat. I had the Long John donuts. I had the hot cereal. I had the cold cereal. I had the eggs. I had the bacon. I had all of this. I ate it all. I took an extra donut back up to my room for later. It was just like this. I go off to my first exam. I'm walking across campus. I am talking to people I don't even know. Hi, how you doing? Oh, it's good to see you. I go into the exam. The exam is multiple choice. I'm in there, and I'm talking to the whole exam. I zip through that exam in 20 minutes. I leave. I go to the student union, and I have a lemonade and a grilled cheese sandwich. Now I go back to the sorority house and I have lunch. Then I'm off to my second exam, which is an essay exam, and was a little trickier. Because as I'm writing and everything's wearing off, suddenly I draw a blank. Where am I? Well, they let me finish the test, but I got an A and a B on those tests. And now I knew how to go through college. And that is how I did go through college. When I came back from that whole thing, I went to a party, drank, came in, landed on my roommate was gone, landed on her bed, flat down. In those days, you didn't wear pants to campus. I'm in a little suit and all that sort of stuff. Landed face down, contact lenses, buried in the pillow, and woke up 48 hours later. But seriously, I had found the answer. So that is how I went through college. And this is, you know, I can get bogged down in college alone, but let's get on. Now I'm graduating from college. This is where I go to that, I'm doing that script. I go to that first AA meeting in Honolulu. And now I've moved to San Francisco. And I'm going for a job interview. I had a lot of potential, you know how that is. Going for a job interview. And I'm in you know, I watch Mad Men now, and it really, that was, you know, that's my time period, that was my life, it was really like that. I'm in a little peach coat, with a little matching scarf, high heels, bone, I believe they were, and a little bone matching purse, and bone gloves. And I had an interview with Herb Cain, for those of you who know who he was. And he helped get me my first job, which was at the New Yorker magazine, the advertising office out here in the West Coast. And it was very much like you see on TV, including those bras and the girdles, got those pointy things. I didn't even own jeans, you know. So anyway, so the guy I worked for found out that I'd never smoked dope. And he, as so many people are with dope, said I just said, I think I tried it once. Or maybe I hadn't even tried it then. I can't remember right now. But he said I just needed, you know, the right kind. So he lived on this in Sausalito overlooking the bay. And he said, come on, come home with me. And I'll fix you dinner and we'll get high. So came into his house and he rolled a joint. I smoked the joint. Nothing. He said, okay, well, this is better stuff. So he rolled me another joint. I smoked it. Nothing. So maybe you need a little wine. So he gave me a glass of wine. He rolled another joint. He's making this thing called shepherd pie. You know, that meat with the mashed potatoes. Okay, the next thing I remember is he's grabbing my head and whipping it back like this as I'm landing face first in the shepherd pie. And as he pulled my head up, I realized I was going to be sick and that I had no idea where his bathroom was. This is the early 70s. I made a beeline for what I thought was his bathroom. Now, who has shag rugs in the bathroom? Really? Just, you know, projectile vomiting. And swear to God, this guy thought he was going to get lucky that night, you know? All I knew was I was going home. So he drove me home across the Bay Bridge, and it was kind of like watching, what's that, the thing, Be Our Guest, you know, the one with the little, that cartoon, Beauty and the Beast. It was like watching the street lamps dancing and turning, and oh, it was a bad experience. And I realized that dope probably wasn't for me. So I kept drinking, and it got worse. So I went on to the next job, similar type thing. I'd come to San Francisco because I was dating a guy who was doing his residency at UCSF Med School. And things hadn't been working out real well because he was, I was drinking too much is what it was. And so we'd gotten back together and we were going to a party, a work party, where the vice president of our company's house, and he was going to be my date. And it was an engagement party for some of the people who worked there. And so this guy had this Kaiser Wilhelm kind of old World War I German, you know, helmets and swords and stuff like this. And this other guy and I had a little bit too much, and we were kind of goose-stepping around the place. So forth. And the next thing I know, I woke up in bed with the Midwestern manager who I didn't really know, but I was in bed with him, naked. It was the morning. I was still in the house of the vice president. My date was nowhere to be seen. That was our last date, oddly enough. And I again knew that I was, you know, I knew it was coming both ends, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And that's a hard decision to have to make, you know? I still made no real connection between drinking and issues, but things were starting to deteriorate in the work department. And so, let's see. Now it's 1972, and the same group of people introduced me to this woman who becomes my first woman lover. And she introduces me to Birkenstocks. And jeans. She was kind of a hippie. And so we're going on vacation up to Mendocino, and we stop and buy me a pair of Birkenstocks on the way. Really, could it be any more cliche? And they only came in gold, this wide gold suede. So you look like a duck, you know. And keeping in mind, I still wore matching pumps, bags, and gloves, and did not own jeans. So we go up there and did not own socks. So we go to Mendocino, and I think these are the most god-awful shoes I'd ever worn in my life. They were so uncomfortable. I had low arches. You know, it was just killing me. And I wore them for about 4 or 5 days, and she said, look, just try them one more day. If you don't like them, then give them up. So I got, and I had to go to the hardware store to get a pair of socks, because my feet were freezing. I mean, you know. So I get up the next day, and it's like, oh, wow. This is great. I go back to San Francisco, I'm getting ready to go to work, put on my high heels, and said, oh, I can't do this. That quickly, I was sold. So I wore Birkenstocks to work, which was frowned on in my profession. So the only thing I can think of is that I need to move someplace where I can wear Birkenstocks, and it'll be okay. So I just made a decision to move back to Hawaii with the girlfriend. Back to where my parents live. Hadn't quite thought that one through because I really wasn't ready to come out. Didn't actually think I was a lesbian. I just thought, you know, I'd happened to fall in love with a woman. So, boy, that was a mistake. I was there a year, a month, 10 days, and 10 hours. Got on a plane, came back to San Francisco, But the one thing that was good about it was while I was there, I met the woman who brought Birkenstocks to the United States and came back here and opened the first Birkenstock store. And then went on to do another one and so forth and so on. So Birkenstocks kind of changed my life in several ways. In 1978, about, I had stopped working for them, and I was working for the women's pro softball team in the area, and we had a press conference. A lot was hinging on that. I was in charge, and it just was a lot of pressure, you know, so I thought maybe if I had a little of that champagne that was sitting around, it might help. Upshot was that I was drunk for the press conference and came just this close to losing the job. But I did realize that, you know, I really couldn't keep this up. I mean, I've glossed over a lot of this, but I was really having trouble with my drinking. It was clear that there were problems. It was an issue. And so I did the only thing I could think of that made any sense to me, and that was I was on to another lover by now who did smoke a lot of dope. And so the next day, before I got out of bed, I rolled a joint and I said, this is how I'll control my drinking. So I started smoking dope again. And or started smoking dope other than that one little seance. And and I always like to give my mom credit when I can. She was right. It did lead to harder drugs. So somewhere in there, this friend came in about 1 a.m. into our house and said, you guys have got to try this. And she had cocaine. And I spent the next... Sorry to those of you who don't like to hear about drugs, but too bad. My story. I spent the next 2 years trying to duplicate that particular high that night. In the meantime, the woman who brought Birkenstocks to the United States made up a job for me. It was a great job. Got to travel, got to teach people how to sell, fit, etc. Birkenstocks. I was like a Birkenstock nut. I love Birkenstocks. This was a great job. You know, it was... Well, I didn't eat meat by then. I didn't eat sugar. I was clean living. Organic cocaine. I lived in San Rafael then, and we had this house. I lived with two other roommates who were always trying to get me to go to Est to get my life together. And so we looked out over the bay and everything, and there was a little store down below called TNT, Throckmorton and something or whatever. It was run by Bubba Freejohn people. And I swear to God, you'd go in there to, you know, you'd be in the melon department and some clerk would come up and start giving you a massage. Well, that was just a little creepy to me. But I found that if I took a half a Quaalude, I rather enjoyed it. So it was, let's see, it was February of 1980. Some friends of the people I lived with came to the house and they said that they were going to this thing called Al-Anon. And they started describing why they were going to Al-Anon, and I realized that that was my problem. My lover was an alcoholic. I didn't mention that to her, but I knew that if I went to Al-Anon, it would be really helpful. And so I started coming to Oakland to Al-Anon with these people. We would go to lesbian Al-Anon. And I'd come over and join them for dinner. We'd smoke a little dope, go off to the Al-Anon meeting. As I mentioned the other night, if you want to smoke dope and go to meetings, Al-Anon is the program you want to go to. They love it when you're stoned and speaking. They just love it. So My sponsor kept telling me to go to more AA meetings to learn about alcoholism. She was in both AA and Al-Anon. And, oh gosh, so somewhere in there, I took her advice. Oh, I know what happened. Funny that I forget this. I'm having a little trouble at work, you know, story of life. And I'm standing in the middle of the office space where there it's this like centered place and there are all these offices off there. And I am telling off the national sales manager. Just, and the thought occurred to me, this might have been a mistake. And then we're trying to get, you know, this is before Birkenstocks were everywhere, so we're trying to get Birkenstocks in places. And so the owner of the company and I are going to Tri-City Sports, to sell Tri-City Sports on Birkenstocks. And I do a couple lines of cocaine beforehand, and I'm the one who's showing them how to fit. And I'm leaning over this guy's foot, and I forgot to mention, I'm violently allergic to whatever the cocaine's been cut with, and snot is just rolling. The owner is just looking aghast at me. And but I was also running a fever of about 103 and ended up being delirious, and I really did have the flu and was out for a couple of weeks. And so I was in over my head at that job, I might add also. I mean, it had been made up, but what the job really was kind of everything that nobody else in the company did also. And I was a little freaked out that, you know, I was going to get found out. And in fact, they did find out. They found all the stuff I hadn't done, you know, there. And the other thing I was doing is that I wanted to be popular, so I was in charge of what Birkenstocks might have cosmetic flaws. And so basically, Hannah, if you wanted a pair of Birkenstocks, I'd take your size and I'd find you the style that had a cosmetic flaw so that you could have it at a reduced rate. And I was doing this for all my friends and for people I work with. And I was also working on special projects, and my boss asked me when I came back to work, asked me to meet her for breakfast one morning. And so I met her for breakfast, and she just seemed pretty upset. And the next day she said, can you meet me tomorrow too? And this day she brought her husband, who was a shrink. And she said, you know, Bobette, I don't know what's wrong with you, but you can't work here anymore. You're crazy. And I took the table and I stood up and I turned the table up and I said, who in the fuck do you think you are that you can fire me? Your boss. Her husband said, God, you know, don't you love when people say this? This may be the best thing that's ever happened to you. And it was. It was the one thing that would have gotten my attention, and it did. Some people who were in women's music said, if you ever stop doing Birkenstocks, come see us. 10 days later, I was working for them. Here's the little catch about that. With the exception of two people in that office, everybody was clean and sober. It's really hard to keep that up around people who are clean and sober. I immediately had trouble showing up when I was supposed to, so forth and so on. July 10th of 1980, I went to a meeting over here at Prince and Telegraph, the lesbian meeting. I thought I heard my story that night. I thought that the thing I needed to do was to do a fourth step in Al-Anon, have everything revealed to me, fix my life. I went across the street to the liquor store. I thought, what can I drink and not get drunk? I got a couple beers. I drove home to Marin. I went in the house determined that I was going to do this fourth step. Whether it took all night, even if it meant not going to work the next day, I was going to do the fourth step. I was on the way. And I walked in the house and I went to the liquor cabinet. We had gin. We didn't have tonic. Gin was the one thing that I could still count on to get drunk with. And my roommates came in. They said they were going dancing at BJ's, and did I want to go? I said, sure, I'll do the fourth step after that. So I smoked a joint, went to BJ's. Don't remember BJ's. I was one of those people who was a blackout drinker right from those early days. in Missouri. I was a blackout drinker all along. I do not remember that night, except like I told you, I was a vegetarian, and what I was told is that I wanted to go to Jack in the Box. Thank God they were closed. But I came home, and the only thing is the next day I got up, and I'd been sick everywhere. And I couldn't throw this one off on that I hadn't eaten or that it was something else. I knew that it was connected to how much I'd had to drink the night before. My roommates were no longer interested in saying, oh, that's okay. One of them just looked at me and she said, you know what you have to do. I called a person I was supposed to have lunch with who was in AA, and I could not face lunch, and she said, well, let's have dinner instead. We made plans to go to an AA meeting at the downtown Webster Street. It was at YMCA, YWCA. She said, look, you don't need to say you're an alcoholic. All you need to do is, you know, just raise your hand and say your name. And I was sweating. God, I was sweating. I'm not somebody who sweats, and I was just sweating like crazy. And I raised my hand, and I said, my name is Bobette. I couldn't say the words. And everybody, I went on around. Halfway through the meeting, somebody said to me, would you like to say something? I said, no, I'm just here. I'm just visiting, just researching, something like that. And everybody goes, ah. And a little while later, you know, it was the same thing as that meeting 10 years before in Honolulu. Everybody was talking about things that I thought only went on inside of me. And they were saying that they were alcoholics. And they were saying that this is where they'd found help. This is where they had found the relief. This is where their lives turned around. So I raised my hand. I thought to myself, what is it going to take, Bobette? Do you need to be 80 years old, no teeth, lying in a gutter? Just raise your hand, say you're an alcoholic. If you don't like it, you can always move. Once an Army brat, always an Army brat. So I raised my hand and I said that, and everybody started cheering. And it was like I thought, you know, I don't think you understood. I said I was an alcoholic. My life changed from that moment on. It has never been the same. It was a hard first year. I do not envy you what you're going through. I do not envy any of you, but let me tell you, if you're an alcoholic like I am, it is worth it. It is worth everything you will go through. I would wake up in the middle of the night just scratching. I was raw with some sort of nerve thing that was coming from detoxing. At 3 months, I started smoking again. At 7 months, I got an obsession that the problem with cocaine for me was that I was allergic to it, and that if I shot cocaine, it would not bother my nose. And I was obsessed with this. And I spoke about it at every meeting I went to. I talked about it to anybody who would give me 5 minutes. I was just all I could talk about. The woman that I'd been with when I got sober, her brother, who was my age, died shooting cocaine. And that was the last time I've had that obsession. I lived for those chips. I stayed sober for 3 months just so I could get a lavender chip. There was just something so gay about it. I did what they told me. They said, make friends with people who've been sober about the same amount of time you have. Those are going to be the people who save your life. And I did, and I'm still friends with those people today. And they have saved my life many times. This was not told to me, but I strongly recommend getting a pettiness sponsor. Because I was one of those people who kind of assigned my sponsor that authority role. She was lovely. She was wonderful. I heard in my first year sober, when I heard her chair her a meeting, and she talked about all these horrible things she'd done, and they were all the same kind of horrible things that I'd done, and I loved her dearly, and I thought, God, if I can love her, then maybe I can learn to love myself. And, you know, it was the beginning of acceptance for me. That said, there were things I wouldn't tell her. I have a pettiness sponsor today who listens to all the petty shit that I come up with that goes on in my head, and I do the same for her. It's fabulous. It really works for me. Pettiness sponsor. Let's see. I'm going to stick quite a bit to just because I'm almost out of time, of course, and because that first year, They Living Sober usually is held in July. That year it was held in August. And I walked around holding onto my sponsor's coattails, and I remember this woman coming in, and I mean, this is just, you know, how I absorb things. And I just thought she was stunning. She came. She was wearing some sort of blue satin jacket and some big white Panama hat, and she came through the whole the Civic Center, and she went to lead her workshop shop, and it was on steps 1, 2, and 3. And I went to that workshop, and she talked about, I came to believe. And I've got my little notebook, and I'm writing this down frantically, you know. It was just, I don't know why that stuff stuck in my brain, but I was a sponge. I was willing to accept all that crap that people talked about. I was willing to accept all that little, you know, all those little things. I came to, my mantra became, show up, pay attention, tell the truth, trust God, clean house, serve others. Don't use, don't run, don't drink. One day at a time, it gets different. I would just say that to myself over and over and over again, and it worked. I love, this book was given to me by that woman who took me to my first AA meeting. I have tried over the years to get rid of this book. I've put it in the box of books that's going out. Somehow it always found its way back under my bookshelf. It's the 12 and 12. It's an older version. The material's the same. But this woman told me that if I belonged here, that there would be a chair with my name on it, and that it would wait for me. And she was right. I love the seventh step. I love the tenth step. I work the steps. Oh, God, I always do this. 1995, I got cancer in my finger. 91, I started meditating again. It's really hard to meditate if you're not sober, I find, if you're an alcoholic and you're not sober. A lot of anger would come up for me in meditating. But when I got sober and had worked the steps and had a way to deal with this, I found meditation to be a real blessing, and I started meditating then and have been meditating ever since. And in 95 I got cancer in my finger and had surgery and had a block, a block for the arm, and I meditated through the surgery and didn't have any drugs or anything like that. And then in 96 they told me that I had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and to get my affairs in order. And it turned out to be a benign reactive node, but it was a real blessing. It was a time in my life when it was a good time to take stock. And I looked and I realized I had no real regrets in life. You know, I hadn't done things the way I thought I would, but I was really grateful for everything. I could see how things fit together. And that's been my experience. The longer I've stayed sober, the more 2020 my hindsight really is. The more I look back and I see, oh, that thing that I thought was so awful turned out to be just a blip in the road. It was nothing. Who cares? You know? I was very lucky that I did not have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. In 2005, the cancer came back in my finger. It went down to the bone. They had to take out part of the bone, but not. It was not bone cancer. Again, meditated and had the local. And the reason I did this is that when I was first sober, in just a few months, I was my car stopped. I was leaning over it like this, and the radiator exploded in my hand and my face, and I had serious burns on my arm. And a woman from AA came and picked me up and took me to the hospital. And when they tried to give me drugs, she said, "No, she can't have them. She's sober." And she was just sort of a Nazi about the whole thing. I mean, I don't know that that's necessarily the path. You know, I don't really, you know, believe in that for everybody. I think there's, you know, doctor prescribed is fine. But she said this. And so, but what she taught me was about my mind. And she said, you know, I want you to imagine, you know when things are so hot that they almost feel cold? And I could imagine that. And every time I did that, the burning stopped in my arm. So I try to go the non-drug way, because I'm terrified about drinking and using again. So far, it's worked for me. Finally, in 2006, we got a call in the middle of the night, and this is why I was in Honolulu, that both my parents had been found down in their home, that the police were there. And my mom died on the way to the hospital, a heart attack, and my father, they didn't think, would live through the night. Those same friends, that group of people that I'd known all this time, came to my house. They packed us. They got us ready, and in 24 hours, we were in Honolulu. And it was 4th of July weekend. There are no cars. Everybody, they were all rented. People gave us cars. People had us stay in their house. People took care of us. My father ended up living, obviously. He's we've been back there every year. He's had cancer. He's had a bunch of different surgeries. When I was in Honolulu, the last time, when I was still drinking, I got charged for excess baggage, and that was an affront to me. And I was running through the Honolulu airport screaming, "Fucking asshole," at the guy who had the nerve to charge me for excess baggage. And my mother said, "What happened to our Girl Scout?" And my father turned in disgust and left. When I told my parents I was gay, my mom said I was sick and moral, against the Bible, and a prostitute. My dad said, "I don't understand it. In the army, we drum them out. I don't want to understand it, but you're our youngster, and I love you, but you go talk to your mother." Over the years, I made amends to my parents. I'm the one who worked the steps. My parents lived their lives. My mom's mother, I'm the first person in my family to register Democrat. My mom asked, as part of my amends to her, that I not tell her mother that I was a lesbian, that I was an alcoholic, or that I was a Democrat. But if I had to tell her some of that, to tell her that I was a lesbian and an alcoholic. It took me right up until a year before my mother died to learn not to talk politics with her. And that is the gift from the program. My father is in love with my wife. My father refers to us as his daughters. She is my sister when we're in Honolulu. The people who work there say, "Is she really your sister?" We say, "No." But this is how he's come to accept it. And he treats us just like, you know, he adores her. So, you know, that's, we all accept that. That's just fine. It works. But today, I am in charge of all of his business, of everything. And if you could have said in 1979 that the person running to the airport screaming "fucking asshole" was going to be in this position with her father, it would not have happened. I'm the one he's come to trust. This is just how we do it. What it's taught me is that I didn't know whether or not I had that in me character-wise. You know, you don't really know these things until you're forced to show up, to pay attention, to tell the truth, to trust God, to clean house. Oh, and boy, do we have to clean house. My parents, well, that's another story. So where it is today is that we don't have a whole lot going on right now. Everything is a day at a time. It's all about my father has cancer again. He's been given about 6 months, whatever. We spend every year there. I spend several months there a year. Every day is about that. And it's all okay, you know. AA and the people in AA have given me the strength to live life on life's terms. The other day I was at some place where in the past I would have felt judged, kind of like this, and I felt comfortable in my own skin. And if all I had gotten in sobriety was to be sober and to feel comfortable in my own skin, that is way more than I bargained for when I walked through the door. That is the biggest gift that, you know, I mean, it's what I always wanted. It's what you were talking about, you know. So, sorry that I've gone over 4 minutes, but thank you for listening, that's it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.